Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Following a world news roundup, we're going to have an interview with the 1.0 draft champion, the 1.0 joust champion, and a total of 3 out of 4 melee finalists. We'll then have our tip of the week and some closing comments.
Okay, John, this is episode 40. Wow.
This is a big one.
It is. This is also a bit of a weird one. Almost all our recording had to take place basically today. We tried to get a whole bunch of people in from Worlds. The way that that worked out, so if you're looking for a ton of 2.0 content, because that was later in the week, most of that will be in our episode next week. We're going to have the champions on. We're going to have a chance to talk to them. We've already lined up interviews with semi-finalists as well. It will be great. Right now, it's going to be great for first edition primarily in this episode. But the reason, I guess maybe we should have started. Worlds happened.
Yeah, and I heard there was a ton of champions because there was 5 pretty big events going on.
5 pretty big events and some other events around the world. So I guess we could start with a sort of quick tournament roundup. Before we mention Worlds, there was a 1.0 national championship in the Philippines, won by Keno, who won with a Lannister No Agenda. But that's the only 1.0 tournament I have. The rest is
Worlds.
That's the only tournament outside of Worlds I have. So maybe in order, the day before Worlds started, there was an inaugural little 2.0 tournament, the Laughing Tree tournament, with 31 players, which was won by Andre with Greyjoy Fealty. And really, the second place was a Stark Banner to Greyjoy. Third place was Targ Fealty. Fourth place was a Lannister No Agenda. So that was a sign of nothing to come, quite interestingly. Then there was the draft championship.
Yeah, won by Ryan Jones, who played Stark all day, strangely enough.
So we have him on this episode. So we'll have the champions in the order that they won. That was 49 players. That's the first time they've ever done a draft championship and assigned a card design. Day 2 was the joust.
Yeah, and Jakob won from Switzerland, which was – Sweden.
Oh, you got yourself there. Not bad, ooh, not bad.
So Jakob represents Sweden very well and took down the last ever joust. Congratulations to him and the rest of Team Europe.
Team Europe, that was spelled Y-U-R-O-P, just to annoy me, I think.
Isn't that perfect? I'm sorry.
that was 94 players this year, so that's down from 141 last year. Obviously, we expected that. We haven't been recruiting all the people. It was also midweek, which isn't ideal.
And 5 days.
It'll certainly be easier next year with just melee joust and so on for 2.0. I do want to mention some interesting sorts of things that happened. So we'll obviously, again, be interviewing Jakob. But, for instance, we got to see a grudge match between Seth Lowe and Dave Bamford. If you'll remember, we sort of started a cast with Seth about bad cards for his sort of uncalled-for comments and in tone criticizing Dave Bamford, the UK champion's decks. We got to request from the FFG Live streamers that of all the top 8 games, they show us that one. They did. Seth won that game, so it must mean that Dave Bamford had a bad card in his deck.
Or several. Like, you know, who knows? We'd have to get Seth to really tell us.
Actually, Dave Bamford was playing a very, very interesting deck, the House of Dreams, Doran Solar, with some fun cards in there that I'm sure would be considered bad cards, but things like Dragon Bone Dagger, which are just so fun with the Doran Solar.
Right. And I mean, he's on that other podcast, which is just one level below our own, so.
The Banter Behind the Throne?
Yeah. It's funny, though.
We're allowed to name them, John. We're allowed to name them.
The banter behind the throne.
What else do we have? It's also worth noting that the top 16 was a sea of Southern California players playing a Lanny Alufin apart and DC playing a Stark House of Dreams.
And this was the first time that Southern California really decided to build as a group, and it obviously paid off.
I don't exactly know what spawned it this year, what motivated them, whether they were just that happy with the deck
one of them
had come up with, or whether it really was, you know, not as much time to test, and so they had to just do one. I don't know.
Or
we should have asked when we recorded.
Maybe they just adopted a DC mentality to building. Maybe they realize there's some value in that, and we're going to see more of it in the future.
I do want to comment a little bit on the house standings, which were really rather surprising to me. The house standings overall for the tournament was 24% Stark, which is the DC bump. They were playing Stark, so obviously that faction is going to be overrepresented. I think there were 12, 15 of them in a 94-person field, so that skewers that. Then a lot of Lannister, again, skewered probably by the many SoCal players playing that. But next up at 18% was Targ, and I am very surprised to see that.
Well, I think Targ Summer was something people realized was a good deck and were hoping to surprise people with. Of course, it wasn't much of a surprise.
Well, it surprised me, so would not have expected Targ to be up there. You know, Martell at 15, Barra was lower than I expected at 11. I thought that there would be more push given some of the Barra decks that had been tested.
Yeah, maybe a Barra Conquest to Stark would have been fun and strong, but we didn't see any of that.
I don't know. I still think you'll see more Barra at Stalic than 11%.
We'll see some Euro Knights for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then, Greyjoy at 11%. You know, we were talking about how cancels that do well was the least represented house, but it won, so.
Oh, I hear Greyjoy draw is really good. That's the rumor.
Day three, then, was the Melee, which is kind of weird. We've mentioned this in the past. It's always previously been Melee before Joust.
And yep, but that was because we had the overall, and this year we did not.
Correct. It's a bit of a shame. I actually prefer Melee first, not even anything to do with the tournament structure, but I just find that it eases my nerves a little bit more. It's more about the interaction with the other players, and the mistrigger isn't always quite as dangerous.
It's more social, and I think it's great that all the Thrones players get together and do the social thing before they get all serious in the joust. I agree with you, Alex.
So that was 57 players. The final table was two DC players, Corey Faraday and Seth Lowe, as well as Ryan Jones and Andreas Aldrin from Sweden.
Yes, and Ryan's from SoCal.
So that did mean that out of those three big tournaments, the Draft, the Joust, and the Melee, we had two players who performed consistently exceptionally well. And those were Ryan Jones from SoCal, who placed first, third,
and Little
third,
C.
And Little C from DC, who was at the final table in every single format with second, second, and fourth.
He has done so well at nationals, in regionals, in worlds. He just seems like that, you know.
But he's playing unlucky. He'll eventually get it.
I feel for him.
And then, so that was the 1.0. If there had been an overall, it would have gone to Ryan Jones by a hair on points. But again, Seth performing very, very well and deserves credit. That sort of consistent performance will eventually get him something quite impressive. So moving on then maybe to the second edition. This was on Saturday. The Joust had 117 players.
So bigger than the 1.0?
Bigger than the 1.0. I was sort of unsure what to expect, and initially I'd sort of thought, well, I'd guess half of the 1.0 players will be either sticking around for it, the Joust players, because I know some people who were leaving couldn't make it around for the Melee or couldn't spend as much time. And I don't think there'll be people coming just for 2.0 because it's the core-only environment. So we might get some Conquest runoff, but nobody who plays Netrunner because they're at the same time. I think about this stuff way too much. I'm actually pretty happy with 117 players.
I thought it was good, and the diversity of the decks was awesome. Like, I was expecting a lot of Targ and a lot of Barra. But, hey, Martell won. Good for you, Sam.
Yeah, First, so there are some comments about how the podcast all called it wrong, and then another one saying, oh, now they're going to say they were always saying that Martell was decent, and they're going to justify it. I'm eating my hat. I was willing to go out there and post what I thought the standings would be for the Swiss and for the cut, and I was horribly wrong. I thought there'd be way more better than that in the field. I thought there'd be way more better than that in the cut. I certainly had Targ pegged as one of the top two there for representation, but I thought that Lanny would squeak in third in the cut, which it didn't. You know, we called it wrong.
I'll share in Alex's hat stew here. I haven't been playing a lot of 2.0 because I felt like I knew where the meta was going to evolve to, and I felt like the meta was just catching up because I was lucky enough to playtest. But Martell was not a deck I thought was going to be winning Worlds. So that just shows me that the core set is even deeper and more interesting than I thought. And that actually invigorates me. I want to get into 2.0 even more now.
And I am so happy to be wrong. And that's why, you know, again, these comments which are like, oh, and now they'll pontificate, you know, that it wasn't, they're not directed at us. It's just at podcasts and community figures in general. Now they'll pontificate and, you know, either claim they were right all along or that they almost had it right. And that's not what I'm saying. I'm extremely happy to be proven wrong. I'm delighted that we have these decks built in different ways, that he was running plots that I have not been running and that I've been dismissing in Joust formats like Clash of Kings.
No, I have
perfect plot for his deck.
I have to say, Alex, I liked Left and Right.
Well,
okay. I was on the record for that one, and there it is, winning major events.
Let's also be clear, just because, and this is the same argument, you know, oh, I want a tournament with a 63 card deck doesn't necessarily make
it right.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
Sam is a phenomenal player, and his deck is excellent, and it was really interesting, and I love the fact that it made the final, and I was definitely cheering for it, despite the fact that it was facing off against Greyjoy, you know, my favorite house, so all of that. But you also can't say that that makes Martell the best house.
Martell's the best house.
I'm not saying it's the worst. I'm saying at this point now, I don't know, and I love that. Yep. I think that's fantastic.
A lot of great decks out there. And really, there's a lot of player skill there. Like, watching Sam play, he was doing things that a lot of new players to the game would never do, like saving his locations that he can pop to get reduction of three for 1, 2, 3 turns in the future, because he knew he was going to Varus on turn three, or he knew that there's going to be certain types of board presence. That's really tough decisions and very well played on his behalf. So
finally, on the Sunday, and this is it really was billed even more as a side event. It's also the travel day.
It was
run differently.
Pretty side.
It was the Melee. It was 53 players, which is still pretty good.
Swiss-style Melee.
Yeah, well, actually,
I heard that 1.0 was that too. Like, what's up with that? That's bad.
Even stranger, and I don't have confirmation on this, and again, because we're doing all of this so last minute to try and get this cast up, I can't really hunt down more. But as I heard it, the 1.0 Melee was also Swiss pairings for the second round, so putting players that had won, but then randomized pairings for the third round. I think that must have been a mistake in that someone had entered it that way. I think that because they weren't doing a cut for the 2.0 version, they decided to go with Swiss pairings the whole way through.
Which makes more sense, a little bit.
Yeah, but that brings me on to another thing. So they released the Taking the Black chapter pack at Worlds. It's not wide released yet. I'm sure we'll have it within, you know, about 2 weeks in most of the rest of the world. But they allowed it for the Melee and didn't allow it for the Joust. And I'm actually 100% behind not allowing it. It was too close, and they didn't tell people in advance that it would be allowed. It shouldn't have been allowed. But again, making the Melee on the travel day, making it not have a cut, giving it the chapter pack, it sounds like they just wanted Melee to be the little fun after event.
Yeah.
But I'm a little worried at the way that was presented, because it devalues the perception of Melee.
Which it shouldn't, because actually in 2.0, Melee is a better game than it was in 1.0, and in 1.0, it was fantastic.
Well, yeah, and it's, I mean, maybe it's just that's the way it had to work out, but by giving it a sort of different set of rules and saying, yeah, you guys can do this in the just play for fun. We'll give you the extra chapter pack and we'll run this little tournament as a sort of afterthought. I'm not terribly happy with that. So I hope they do more to increase the image of Melee as a premier event as it becomes it in the next seasons. But I guess that's always a hard situation because there are so few regionals and store championships that run in the Melee format. So maybe that's where they need to start.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Worlds typically, or at least last year, Worlds was the source of a whole bunch of big news items, including the reboot for 2.0. You know, that was a big
deal. No news this year.
It was really quiet. And there are a lot of things that they had talked about at Gen Con and in interviews this year that we were expecting to hear from at Worlds.
Yeah, like Legend of the Five Rings?
That not so much. I didn't expect anything because it's still 2 years off before they start that. Mm-hmm. But for instance, the Judge program, they were talking about that in interviews at Gen Con and before, saying that they'd be telling us about it by Worlds. You know, an official release of Tome, we haven't seen that yet either. The comments about organized play structure for next year, they've been hinting that things would be known by now.
The new promo where people can get paid to promote the games for FFG, nothing.
Yeah, and maybe that's just that it was directed at players who were there and it hasn't trickled through to us yet. Again, we're being...
I don't think so. We would have saw some stuff. we would have heard, Alex.
We still haven't gotten our... Yeah, I have a lot of little birds. And I want to thank my little birds, which sounds so condescending, but a whole bunch of people who would send us information. We tried to maintain the Beyond the Wall Facebook page with as much up-to-date information. The Europeans especially were great about bringing in the standings of all of Team Europe so that we could post those. And
we
records.
Really appreciate that.
But also, you know, I would contact people who are, you know, traveling for their own time, for their own fun.
They're busy, having fun.
And they get back to me and they say, yeah, I'll get the standings for you. Or yes, I'll take a picture of that pie chart. And, you know, I love a pie chart. So
it's your favorite type of pie.
Doing that, and I know they're not doing it for me. They're doing it for the community. But still, thank you on behalf of both me and the community.
And I mean, while we're thanking people, I'd really like to thank all the people that came on the cast today, because most of them are traveling. Most of them are doing this from their hotel room. We have, I think, all the champions almost coming on and talking with us. And I know how painful that can be when you've been partying all night, waking up to get on some cast. Thanks a lot, guys. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. And one other thing that they didn't have was no news about the CP5 spoiler, which I was thinking they were going to hold for Worlds just to give a little extra tidbit, but that didn't happen either, so that's a little weird. So before we close off on this little segment, I do want to mention that there'll be a lot of 2.0 content next week. We may even have something additional special. We've got something in the works that we're quite pleased with. We can't quite talk about it yet. So aside from your tip of the week, most of the content this week will be first edition, but expect champions galore next week. So we're joined live from Worlds, the very last day, by the draft champion. That was how long ago now?
About 4 or 5 days. I think it must have been Wednesday, so it's Sunday now.
One long week for you. So this is Ryan Jones out of Southern California. And for those of you not familiar with him, he is actually the first person to take home 2 card designs out of any tournament ever, winning overall and Melee Championship in Worlds 2013.
And you're probably sad this year there was no overall because your overall record was incredible. I think it was 1-3-3. Is that right, Ryan?
Yeah, I think I took the unofficial title of overall this year. But yeah, I could have used another hammer for the other hand, I feel like, you know.
Could you really dual wield those? They're too heavy for me.
it looks a little bit ridiculous on me because it looks small. Like if John or I hold that hammer, it looks kind of like a prop. But
so this is consistent performance in 2013, where you did something amazing. You actually took basically the same deck to Melee and Joust. I imagine you can't possibly have done that with the draft this year.
Well, of course not. but it's sort of along the same lines. I did play 3 different Stark decks for each of the 3 pods in draft.
Interesting. Even with the different card pools.
Yeah. And it was definitely not something I was targeting. I've had a lot of success with the sort of big, beefy military power characters of Stark and Baratheon in the past, and those generally appeal to me in a pack.
So coming into the draft, what kind of preparation had you done? Had you played a lot of draft in Thrones or in other games?
Not a huge amount in other games, but I absolutely love the format in Game of Thrones. I think it's by far the most enjoyable format for me because I'm not a very technical or diligent constructed deck builder. I love playing Game of Thrones constructed, but it just seems like so much work to me to perfect a deck.
Well drafted.
I just love doing it on the fly, you know? Just limited choices and trying to make the best one. That's my kind of constructed strategy anyway, so it suits my lazy playstyle.
Well, suits strong instincts.
So do you have experience with both card pools, or had you played with both draft sets before?
I've done probably two or three with each draft set in the past. We've got a CCG cube in San Diego that Chris Schoenthal has constructed, and it's glorious. There's nothing but broken cards in it. You can draft wild cards that after the draft is over, you can just go trade it for any other card that wasn't drafted to perfect your deck. So we do a lot of that sort of janky draft, but we hadn't done a whole lot of actual dedicated testing really at all in Southern California. I heard that another meta actually did some really detailed analysis of the draft sets and came in with a really good plan on how to win the draft.
And that didn't work out for them. Do we get any guesses as to what meta that might have been?
That was definitely the DC meta. There were three of them actually in the top cut, and they were all sitting right in a row, which I think really hurt them. Especially since it seemed like with what they all ended up drafting, which was some variant on Targon Martell, that they were all kind of cannibalizing each other's drafts in a row. Right. It was Sam Bratz, Eric Butzloff, and then Seth Lowe were all in a row. And I think I probably benefited from that because all three of them were just passing on these incredible Stark cards. It actually ended up letting me go single house Stark in the finals, and that's what I ended up winning with.
They should have maybe learned a little bit about signaling and making sure that they didn't all use the same strategy when they're paired together. So why don't you tell us about your first pod?
It's a little hazy.
Fair enough.
8 days down, but it was Stark Baratheon. The best thing that the deck did was I opened in my very first pack on Raven's Wings, which for anyone that doesn't know is a 1-3-1 draft format only plot that says, when revealed, if you have no other kingdom plots in your used plot deck, go find a 3-cost character from your deck and put it directly into play. Sort of like at the gates, but for anyone. So at that point, it's all based on the strength of your 3-cost characters. And my general open with it was Tycho Nestoris, who's the +1 gold, economy. And you can trade it for a draw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both of which are very, very limited in the draft format. So being able to start with extra economy or draw pretty much locked up all three of those games. One of my meta mates in another pod also got on Raven's Wings. And this is one of the worst things about Westeros, the second set, is that the prized Daenerys is in the set. So he had on Raven's Wings with Daenerys every single game, first turn on the board with no valor.
Pure win.
Yeah, he also went 3-0 in his pod because there's not much you can do about that. He also drafted Swamps of the Neck, which has some interesting synergy with Daenerys that you can trigger her kill, then remove her from the challenge and win it with anyone else that was in the challenge.
To use it again.
And then to stand her, and then she can use her on the second challenge. So he was doing mean stuff. I'm glad I was not in his pod.
So that means that for the second pod, you were using the older draft set, right?
Yes, Ice and Fire was the second set of three games. The format was a draft of eight, three round Swiss within your pod, and a second set of the exact same thing, and then they cut to a top eight for a final draft and Swiss, a single elimination in the finals.
So before you tell us about that pod, which of the two draft sets do you like more? Do you have a preference, or do you just enjoy both?
I really, really like Westeros over Ice and Fire, other than the fact that Daenerys is in Westeros.
Well, they learned a lot of lessons in the second one. I mean, the first one was the first time they'd tried any LCG draft, period, basically.
Yeah.
And there were some mistakes in there for some of the, you know, avoiding some of the fun things you could do. It wasn't quite as crazy. And
it was a bit bland.
Draft-only cards, which definitely needed to be added.
Another big thing was the starter was a little bit weak. It gave you a C from each house, And I think the Red Keep was the only influence besides that. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple Sea Roads and Rose Roads, and it doesn't give you a very good base to work with. And some people just chalk that up to, oh, it's draft. You're not going to have good economy or an okay curve. But in Westeros, as you were saying, draft-specific locations, they're one-drop, non-limited reducers that also provide influence. And then there's the requisite Rose Roads and Sea Roads. And then there's like a neutral character that reduces out of house stuff. It gives you a lot more flexibility on what you can end up drafting. And I think that makes for better and more interesting decks in the second set.
All right. So tell us a little bit about the second pod.
That was the winner's pod. They did sort of a Swiss pairings to get you into your second set of pods. Mm-hmm. So most of us were three. So the table was obviously stacked. Drafting went a lot harder at that table. It's often the case that with a mixed group of skill levels, the better people can just sort of snag all the best things as they come around that aren't obviously great, but that doesn't happen much at a great table. I drafted Stark to Martell. I think I had four Orphans of the Greenblood. I made setups real nice, and then I had one or two Gamus of Oss, which ended up being huge in an environment where there's no way to get rid of the renowned characters off the board easily. So I actually ended up making the cut due to a top deck of Orphan of the Greenblood paired with a Gamus of Oss that I was able to strip the intrigue icons off of a beefed up Daenerys so I could push through the Gamus of Oss on a Balin with like 10 power on him.
Oh,
it was a crazy play. And then I was able to come back with Fat Bob, Rob, Eddard, and like a 2-claim power challenge for the win. It was a really, really great game. Sadly, it was against one of my metamates, James, and I felt awful because I thought it was the play-in game, and we were both going super hard trying to win it, and it was just I kind of just ripped it from his grasp, and then it ended up that I think he made it at either 8 or 7.
He made it at 7, yeah.
So I didn't actually knock him out, so I felt good about that.
Yeah, really interestingly for that top 8 cut, looking at it right now, is that 6 out of the 8 were from that winner's pod.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting how that goes. If you start 3-0 and then go 1-2, you still end up at 4-2 with an amazing strength of schedule. I wonder if that pairing sort of keeps up. If you lose early, there's just absolutely no chance.
Yeah, and then you got put in a pod with Eric Butzlaff, who we haven't seen in years. Did you get a chance to face off against him? Or?
I did. We played in the top 4. Played Chris Thompson in the top 8. He had about 5 or 6 great 4-cost characters, and they were all on the bottom of his deck. So there's not a whole lot you can do about that. He was playing Chuds, and I was playing the Blackfish and Robb Stark and Blackfish's Vanguard. So it's just hard to keep up with that renown pressure. That's how that game went. But then I was able to face Eric in the top 4. That was a pretty good game too. A lot of intrigue and Targ from those guys. Martell and Targ, and with a very strong intrigue presence, which, as most people know, Stark has trouble with. But I mostly just let intrigues go unopposed, lose a card, and come back and claim like 5 or 6 power. So I think giving up a card for 5 or 6 power is usually a good trade.
And then the final, you were pitted against the person who would then be your rival for, you know, the next couple of tournaments.
That's right.
Yeah. You faced off against Seth Lowe,
Sorry. So, Alex, actually, just before you go, just to correct, the gentleman's name is Little C that Ryan played. Yeah, some of our listeners might not know Seth Lowe, but Little C was who Ryan played.
So that is correct.
So he was playing a Targ Martell as well?
I'm trying to recall, but I do believe so. He had a Spy from Starfall, which is the Monocon specialized character out of Martell, and he threw Heartsbane on it on either the first or second turn, which stands the character after it wins a challenge. So he had essentially locked up offense and defense intrigue.
For the rest of the game, yeah.
Yes. Yep. Until I could do something to that character, there would be 0 intrigue challenges won. So in total in the game, I initiated and defended a total of 0 intrigue challenges.
hey, don't you know that intrigue is the most important challenge in first edition?
Apparently. It was funny. I was assembling my deck really quick because they actually had deck lists for every card you drafted. Like after you drafted in the pod, you had to record every single card you drafted, and then you had to check a box next to each one that you put in your deck.
Even if you switched between rounds?
They made a point that you could change your deck between rounds, but lay out what your deck was going to be for the first round on this list.
Okay.
But that you didn't have to make changes to your list if you made changes to your deck. That was kind of funny to me. Like it felt kind of moot. Like if it's so important to put a deck list.
Yeah, I agree.
Then why isn't it important if you change it? But if it's not important that you change it, why was it important that we made a deck list?
The cards you drafted are definitely valuable because then, I mean, they could prevent cheating, people slipping cards in. That wouldn't happen absolutely in Thrones anyways, but that's got value.
We were all pretty happy that there was some amount of accountability on, you know, like what was actually drafted so that things couldn't sneak in.
So you managed to win despite losing all the important challenges.
Yeah, apparently. Apparently power and military are pretty important too. I was able to pretty much, I think, win an offensive military challenge every single turn. That's as good as a card to me if he's paying gold for his card.
And sooner or later, you get to a point where you're top decking and you might play out your hand and have nothing left, right?
Several times. But a lot of my draw was challenge-based with the Garda River Run and Blackfish.
Oh,
and right. Cancel Eddard. Cancel targets a noble character.
Yeah,
so that all that draw, I could wait till after he had to do his intrigue challenge and then sneak a couple cards in. So I wasn't really top decking, but I had complete intrigue defense by having no hand.
So you won the tournament. There were some prizes for that. There's a nice picture of you not holding a Warhammer there at that point, but still great stuff. You also get a card design. This is the first time this has ever been done for draft in any of the competitive games out of FFG. Have you talked to Nate about now that you have three card designs, making the three dragon eggs or something amazing like that? Or do you have a special place for a card that it won't be draft only, but maybe will be like the kind of card that you always want to see in a draft set and getting that in there?
There's definitely an appeal to making a card that suits the format in which you won. We kind of been joking around since California doesn't play much Melee. We said the first lines of text on the card, no matter what it is, needs to say draft format only if you have more than one opponent. And then just any text, because it'll never be played. So it's only in draft Melee. Actually, there was an announcement at the beginning of the tournament that the Game of Thrones draft Melee will be starting in 5 minutes. And there was a huge roar from the crowd of, what are you talking about? I must be in the wrong place. Like, do not make play a draft.
Draft Melee, that would be great. I'm excited.
So obviously that will not be what the card is, but the three thing, it definitely gives you a chance to have some synergy between them, either as obviously as the dragons or dragon eggs or something subtler. I think my current plan is to not put all my eggs in one basket, but to sort of spread them out.
Yeah, win two more card designs and do all the Stark kids.
Oh, man. That's too much pressure.
Hey, at the rate you're going, It's not outside of the realm of possibility.
So that was draft. I heard you did good in other events like the Joust the next day. Could you tell us a little bit about the deck you took to Joust?
Sure. San Diego mostly played the same deck. We had a couple outliers, but we haven't done that a lot in the past where we all sort of workshop a deck and then really grind out a bunch of games and testing. But this year we did. The deck was built by one of our guys, Johnny Wright. He is
a newer
player. He did. He made it over dinner before we were about to play a couple Octagon games together. And he said, I'll be ready in about 30 minutes. I've got this janky Klansman deck you're going to hate. Got those first couple games in, and he went 5-0 against five different great top meta decks. And I said, oh, Johnny Wright, I do not hate this deck. In fact, I think we're all going to play this at Worlds, and I think it's going to win. And he was skeptical because he's a very modest person. But we ended up getting our Lanny Lufin Apart deck really, really tight and ready for everybody. And it ended up performing really well. SoCal had five in the top 16. Sadly, four of us had to play first round.
Yeah,
so
I saw that.
I think the deck had to cannibalize a little bit. But Johnny Wright and I ended up third and fourth. in the Swiss, and then we ended up third and fourth because we both made the top four and then lost.
One of your games was streamed, the top four game. We got a chance to see you play. Now you're a Greyjoy player at heart.
No, false.
No, false? I always thought that given that you'd played the same deck in both Melee and Joust 2013, that Greyjoy was your appeal, and you should know about cards like Seasick. Yeah, I think you should maybe play a Seasick.
It's the worst play I've ever done in my entire Thrones life to not play the sea in my hand before my big trick, and then just getting Seasick off a one of in Dark Wings. Thanks for ripping the scab, Alex.
I could not resist. I mean,
no,
at that point,
I really do feel that I could have had a great shot at taking Yakov down, but if I had done the right play.
I missed the video, so why don't you tell me a little bit about your deck since I didn't get to see it in action?
Well, the deck is Lannister, the agenda is Aloof and Apart, and the restricted card is the event Wheels Within Wheels. I think that's about all I'm allowed to say based on a comment from Johnny Wright as the original deck builder.
I saw a mention somewhere that deck list would be posted. I don't know if it's going to Stalic with someone or something like that.
I think that plan may have changed. The plan to post it, yeah. There's that one last big tournament, right?
Stalic.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's fine if it's posted after Stalic. I think it should be posted at some point, no?
That will absolutely happen.
Okay. I mean, people who want to check out a snapshot of the deck can watch your match and see the pieces. No, it's up there,
it's
on Twitch.
True. It's all there.
Yeah. It's not all there because you didn't get to flip into your big trick. There are lots of potential tricks there that could be a veteran could see, but without knowing your plot deck, we have no idea what amazing trick it was going to be.
Yes. Anything else in the Joust that was cool? Did you play against a really tight match against someone or something you wanted to comment on?
You got to play Seth again, didn't you?
I did. We played in the Swiss. I think round five or six, we were both undefeated. And we had a really sloppy game. The two of us were just laughing at it because I think we were both in a position that we were probably both going to make the cut. I think we were kind of relaxing, as it were, and just kind of going through the motions, and we had so many misplays between the two of us. It was embarrassing, but we both tightened it up. Obviously, Seth made a real good run to the finals. He's a great player. He just had the right number of cards in his deck, I guess. 60, you know?
how many did you have?
We had 62, but...
John Bruno would be proud, but I'm not sure.
No, sorry. I misspoke. 60 as well.
Oh, 60 as well.
Yeah.
Well, now John Bruno would be disappointed. Tight 60.
Yeah, he was in favor of adding a few extra answers. There was a really nice, interesting conversation about that in the bar last night between LaPlante and Seth about number of cards in the deck. It was heated, but it was still friendly. So it's still a great topic in Game of Thrones that I don't think will ever be solved.
See, it's math. It's so easy.
I totally agree with you. I'm in the 60 boat, but I've also seen my buddy John Bruno take it down with 63 twice. Yeah, so.
Yeah. Well, debate for another eon, I'm sure.
True. I think it'll go on forever.
So finally, for 1.0, not finally, period, you played in the Melee, did exceptionally well, went all the way to the final table. Again, it seems like a couple of SoCal players were playing a similar deck.
Yeah, I've been playing a Heir to the Iron Throne deck for the last year and a half, only because I don't have the energy or desire to build another deck. It gets a tweak like once a year before a tournament, so... But a lot of us were playing Heir to the Iron Throne Targ, and so were a lot of DC guys, Corey and Eric Butzloff, at the least, and we're playing that. So it seemed like a popular deck, and man, if we said that the Intrigue Challenge was jokingly the most important in draft, there is nothing more important than a Power Challenge, and if you get two of them, the math works out, right?
It's good. It's good.
Get twice as many of the most important challenge in the format than anyone else. Mm-hmm. And plenty of ways to abuse it as well, like my favorite card in that Horse Gate.
Wonderful two claim, three challenges, and stealing six power there for the swing.
Yeah.
So I know that we'll have Andreas on for a little bit to talk, and we'll probably manage to get Seth a little bit because there seemed to be some controversy about the Melee final. Before we contaminate that with what we think, just any thoughts on the final that you want to chat about?
I think no one should be surprised that there was controversy at a Melee final table. It's a tradition now.
Now, of course, Ryan, having performed so exceptionally well in first edition, I know your showing wasn't quite as strong at the second edition Joust tournament, but I'd like to hear what your thoughts are with second edition going forward, with whether you're waiting until the card pool builds up, whether you enjoyed it this year or not.
Well, I actually was pleasantly surprised by the 2.0 Joust and the level of the decks in the play. I thought it might be a little bit of a learning tournament. And in some ways it was for me, as I lost a game trying to trigger responses to winning at the end of the resolution, which is not how it goes anymore. Yeah. I was even saying the acronym every single time and still just went right into claim and then tried to stand my Asha and went, oh, no, that'd be for first edition, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And it cost me a game. That exceeded my expectations for the level of competition in the decks. And maybe that just speaks to it being a world championship and there being a card on the line. But I'm very excited for it going forward. A lot of our casual play has been sort of not boring, but kind of bland as far as decks and everyone learning. But this was another level, and it was very exciting to be in it. I ended up 5-2, but I'd lost my first game. So you start getting the lower strength of schedule, and I got bummed out on that.
Yeah, so did a couple other SoCal. I saw Brooks at 17 and Chris Joenthal at 18
but we had Johnny Wright at 16, so
yeah,
we had three California players all in a row right near the top, but sadly there's right at the bottom of the top, so two of them
the bottom of the top there. I will also say my thoughts just from looking at the field, I wasn't there, is that the core has more depth than we had suspected, and
we knew absolutely correct.
I mean, we knew it had depth, way more than the first edition core and way more than a lot of other games. But to see those decks that rose to the top, to see some of the plots in those decks, which are plots that people, including ourselves, have dismissed, is so encouraging. It's just a great sign.
It's great. I definitely did not think it was going to be this good, and it's such a successful launch and such a successful environment.
Okay. Well, any final thoughts? Will you be at Worlds next year winning 2.0 things?
Or at Gen Con?
I think it's generally been that SoCal will do one or the other. It's probably going to be Worlds. Worlds is so much fun. Gen Con is huge and a blast. I've only done it once, and I'd really like to do it again. But I think the plan is for now that SoCal will be at Worlds next year doing all the 2.0. It'll be nice not having to do 5 tournaments in a row.
Oh, yeah, that sounds harsh.
I was actually really excited for so much Game of Thrones all week long, but I did not consider what making the cut and playing several games in the cut in each of them was going to mean for my sleep and my health and then my inability to say no to go out to the party at the bar every single night really did not help. Thursday night was Matt Lay's last night at Worlds, so that usually indicates that there will be a very, very large raucous party, and then it did happen. So Friday morning for the Melee was a little difficult.
You sounds like you had fun. Sounds like you're eager for more and looking forward to second edition, and it sounds like you have amazingly consistent performance. We're expecting great things from you next year.
Yeah,
I don't like the pressure, but I will. Thanks for having me on, guys.
John, since you nicknamed this guest, and everybody in the community knows his nickname, and I actually agree with it, unlike Little C, why don't you start us off, John?
We are here with Jakob, the Giant Underpants, and he is going to be the last ever Game of Thrones 1.0 Joust World Champion, and it was awesome for me to wake up in the morning and watch your game, because it was a little late at night for me to finish, and I had work, but I woke up 7 o'clock, I didn't read anything, and I watched the last 10 minutes of the game, and actually that was basically the whole game, so it was great to see you winning. Seth's a great player, but you were playing a unique deck. something that looked really fun, and I gotta say I was happy to see you win.
Thank you very much, John.
Could you tell us about that unique deck? Because you were playing Greyjoy, Dark Wings, Dark Words, and I don't think there's a lot of people there playing a deck like that.
No, that is correct. And pretty much everyone that I played against that day and spoke with that day about that deck, they were raising their eyebrows and were like, what? And even you, Alex, we spoke on Skype the week before, you were like, is there even a deck like that?
I think my exact words were something like, I heard that some people were playing that. I was never convinced that it worked. You said, add draw to Greyjoy. And then I went, yeah, I remember the long voyage.
Yep. So the story about this deck is that actually I've got to get all the credits to one of the guys in my meta called Bjorn Jorner. He's a Greyjoy player at heart. He always plays Greyjoy. Oh, not when Mel's favor was out. Then he played Barra. But he's a Greyjoy player, and in the playtesting up until Worlds, me and Andreas, we tried to find the best decks. We wanted to play something fun. I wanted Burn to work because, you know, Burn got a great hit with threats, but I still thought if I could find something, that would probably be very good. Tried a lot of different decks, and I ended up getting beat by Bjorn with this Greyjoy Dark Wings Dark Words deck in every single game. It beat Lani NA Alvaro style. It beat Martell, different agendas. It beat Stark. It beat Tark, Burn. The only thing it struggled with was Barra. And I was like, okay, this deck wins 15, 16, 17 games in a row. And I couldn't really see why. It's just a very old school Raider deck with some high claim, with the surprise events. And yeah, like you said, Alex, it's a draw.
So what worked for Greyjoy in the past? I mean,
yeah. So the whole story about what Bjorn wanted to do with this deck was, you know, he remembered the long voyage times and he was like, I want to try and do that again. So it is basically, it's something like a long voyage deck with more cards, a lot of raiders and some natural draw in it. So that is basically the story behind the deck. So I took that 90% of the deck is his core. And we tweaked it, and yeah, it's such a solid deck.
So your restricted was the negotiations, which gave you additional draw. And I saw that you were opening with one of the new castle plots to give you kind
Kings of Mountain more, Vale,
more card advantage off the top.
So, it is a good start because it's 4 gold, which is good in the beginning. Solid initiative against the no agenda decks. You can make them go first if you have events that will do something good against them, or a newly made lore to smash their location, expensive location that they put out first round, etc. So it is a good starting plot. And if you have a bad setup, I mean, it's 76 cards, guys, 76.
Why do you do this to deck. Me? Why do you do this to me, Jakob?
Even Bjorn was like, in the end, you should cut one card. And I was like, nope.
It works this way.
It did. So it's like, it's got 76 cards. So it will have some bad setup sometimes, but it usually sets up 3 to 4 cards, which is all right. But if you have a really bad start, you need the natural draw in the second round.
Because draw, especially in those types of decks with DW, where you're trying to get those events to produce more draw, kind of gives you draw. You need something to kick it off. It's almost like a jump start where someone's pushing down that old car down the hill, and then you can, you know, start it up.
Exactly. That's a good comparison. It's like you need the engine to start going. Yeah. And with the events, it's like you're only replacing a card, so you need the natural draw as well.
Mm-hmm. And just out of curiosity, because you mentioned the deck doesn't set up all that well, we did see in the finals your use of it and your opponent flipping into Valor. And that's one of the initial thoughts I had about that card, Kings of Mountain and Vale, does a lot to dissuade the following turn's Valor. Is that a use you saw out of it, or was it just you didn't have a quite strong enough setups? And so it was rarely the situation where your opponent was forced to Valor turn 2 and then eat the 2-card differential on a Valor turn.
It was rarely a Valor turn 2. The final was exceptionally good first turn, but I usually puke out a lot of cards first turn. And having that threat of, I'm going to pull one card of your hand and I'm going to draw an extra, even whatever you do in the plot phase, it doesn't matter, I will do that. Kind of, like you said, it kind of forced them to make a decision of, should I Valor? Or what can I actually do to get the advantage over this Greyjoy player? But no, I didn't see any Valor turn 2 except for in the final, actually.
All right. Well, so you were representing Team Europe. A lot of people were. You were wearing wonderful pink shirts, right?
Yes. Yeah. It looked like a washed out shirt because the pink color was so bad.
Hey, it's memorable. Everyone will remember Team Europe with the original spelling as well, which doesn't bother me at all in any way. So tell us a little bit about your road to the cut, your road to that final.
Oh, so I first round was tough. I beat the bye. Always tough. And the second round, I played against Torog Hollow Hill, which I knew I had a good chance against. We tested a lot against Torog Hollow Hill, but that was against with Bungled, not with Threats. This guy played Threats, and that was kind of hard to see what he was going to do. But what I did before the tournament, like a few days before, I spoke to Andreas, and he said, you should add Forgotten Plants. And I did, and it worked out great. I blanked his first Snow of Winter with my 7 characters out. 5 of them were 2 cost or lower, and it was game. Mm. I also managed to do pro play without knowing it. He Westeros bleeds. Yeah. He Westeros bleeds me in the dominance phase, and I have Seasick, and he doesn't have any other influence standing. That was just – I was lucky. It was fun. So third turn, I played Dan Seafelt. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Very, very good player, obviously. And he beat me real bad. He played House of Dreams Harrenhal. It was 2 different House of Dreams Harrenhals. The one version he did, he played High Claim and Fear of Winter. Mm-hmm. The one that we'll probably talk about later, the other DC deck was Cities and Narrow Escape. So Dan, he played Fear of Winter. He had a great setup. I had a really, really bad setup with 2 cards, pretty much no economy. I couldn't find any of the natural draw. All of my characters lacked intrigue icons. He emptied my hand with High Claim. It was over very quickly. And I felt very discouraged. I didn't feel good about the deck. I was like, oh, I thought I had a good matchup against Dark. This is bad. So 2-1. So I played, up until the whole Swiss, I played against a Martell No Agenda. I managed to Salt and Iron Quentin first turn, which was beautiful. And then I ended up playing 2 Tar Kings of Summer, one guy from Tulsa, one guy from Texas, and I beat them. So I managed to go like 2-1, 3-1, 3-2, 4-2, 5-2. So I submarine into the cuts, 10th place. So yeah, I was a bit pumped. I had adrenaline. I was not sure to go into the cut, but I did. And up until that point, I started to feel good about the deck. It worked out the last few rounds of the Swiss. It started to get the engine going.
Now, we got a chance to watch your match against on the stream, obviously the final, but also the semi against Ryan Jones. Now, how much of a difference to the match? I mean, you clearly saw the answers to control the draw. You had Newly Made Lord to get rid of that. You got rid of Tommen. You had complete control over that. How much of a difference was his misplay with the Summer Sea or the Sunset Sea?
Oh, it was a great difference. I mean, it won me the match. It did. It definitely did. He, I'm not sure he would have won, but he would have had a chance. He would have had a great chance. I mean, I played against the same deck, but another player from SoCal in the Swiss, and he beat me because he Kings of Mountain and Vale into Rule by Decree in the draw phase, which basically meant I ended up with 3 cards in marshalling.
Yeah, that, my guess was that was what he was attempting to do, was flip into Rule by Decree rather than something like a blockade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Rule by Decree is much more damaging to you.
Wheels in this tournament was a great choice, I think.
Obviously, a lot of our listeners will have watched the final. We got a chance to see you take it down, but we didn't get much commentary from you. So tell us a little bit about how you felt about that, where you felt the turning point was. Was it really just the setup? Or when did you know you'd won that?
I think I felt like when he Valored turn 2, and I could save my Euron's Enforcers, keeping my hand steady. And after his marshalling, and he couldn't really get that many characters out, and I continued pushing with, I can't remember if it was Retaliation I played second round. That was the point where I felt like, oh, he's blown his Valor, and I know that he doesn't play Aftermath. That was it, I think. And also, when I got Baylor Blacktide out, and
Baylor,
I knew that
with
I had
the no quarter in,
and yeah, and then I just tried to play safely all the way through because I know that he was playing Narrow Escape. So I always tried to, going into the challenge phase, keep at least two cards in hand. If he somehow would manage to get an intrigue through, I would still get to ditch one card for the Narrow Escape somehow. So that was my game plan. Yeah, I felt like from the Valor turn and on, it was game for me.
Yeah, I think it was just determined really early. You could kind of see Stark deck crapped out a little bit. Your deck fired on all cylinders, and that disparity was too much. And I think you're both extremely talented players. So it's not like there was a deficit in play skill that Seth could leverage or something. So
no matter what he might believe.
Yeah. we'll leave that there. So, but if he played Sansa as well, and he accidentally showed the card. He thought that he was supposed to show the card that he picked with Sansa. So he showed the Winterfell Heart Tree. And by that point, I felt like, okay, he needs to get that to, you know, get my River Blockade off so he can trigger Harrenhal. It was absolutely game from that point.
Yeah, it certainly was. We saw that play, and we saw him searching through his deck, and it sort of seemed like wistful, as if he was hoping there was another card in there.
Yeah, someone had sneaked in a very good card
even
there.
Even a Northern Patriarch would not have been sufficient at that point.
No. Yeah. And they don't even run it. I spoke to him afterwards.
I know, yeah. That was surprising to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In
very surprising.
John and I had, we definitely had two, I think.
Two, yeah, very strong.
Yeah, it's a given card.
Now, this is not your first card design. We had you on last year around this time of year, just a few weeks later, to tell us all about your fantastic Melee experience winning the European Championship in Melee. So you now get a second card design to complement it. Is it going to be left and right?
We joked about that yesterday. We joked about that. We said, let's do a left and right. That's good.
And then left and right won the second edition tournament. So.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, it would be good to do something that complements the first one.
At least within the same theme, right?
I mean, you could still pick up third one in you're going to Stoic, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So obviously.
Well, get a third and do the dragons.
That's right.
Oh, maybe a fourth.
What are there in fours? Davos' kids, maybe? I don't know. I can't remember specifically. Now, just briefly, obviously not to underplay the value of this Joust Championship, but you did fairly well in the draft, very well in the Melee. You did quite well in the second edition tournament. It was a very solid showing all weekend. How do you do it? How do you do it? Do I have to start eating lutefisk? Do I have to?
Yeah, Alex is
going to eat meatballs
small balls every day.
That's the question.
Yeah? How many meatballs do you eat every week?
Or how about this? Some of our listeners may not know this term, depending on the Nordic country, Jantala or Jantelagen or so on. Mm-hmm. Jakob, tell us a little bit about what that means.
So Jantelagen is something that a lot of the people in the Scandinavian countries, and it's pretty much everyone in Sweden, we have that. It's something that you shouldn't – how should I describe it, Alex? It's like you shouldn't
It's kind of like you shouldn't stand out.
You shouldn't brag. You shouldn't brag about – it's exactly like that. You shouldn't brag. You shouldn't stand out. You're nothing more than anyone else, and – don't think that you can do better than anyone else because you are you.
So how do you reconcile that with being awesome? How do you – I don't understand.
He wakes up in the morning. He puts his giant underpants on and goes outside, Hawks.
I don't know. I don't like to brag. It's not in my personality. I just love this game so much, and I'm competitive, but I want to have so much fun. And it was just to say one thing about the DC crew is that we spoke a lot about these things over the weekend. I had great discussions with Eric Buslaff, with Seth, and it's just like we have so different views of when it comes to competition. I would say that in Sweden, in Europe, our Swedish team, we are all about the community first and foremost. We always speak about that. We always say we have a team captain like Corey. We have Pontus in Sweden who's great at, you know, picking decks for everyone and saying, you are good with this deck and please let's tweak this together for him. But I would never play a game against someone and do something that would, I don't know, you know, hurt their feelings, or I will feel awful. It's not worth it. It's a game. I don't earn any prize money from it. I want to have great fun. That's it for me. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It's a very roundabout way of not answering it that I find acceptable. But hold on. You said, you know, you wanted to have fun and so on. Did you?
Oh, I had great fun. I had so much fun with everyone. This weekend was so great. Not just winning and doing great in the tournaments. There are so many great people in this community, and I had so much fun. The SoCal guys are awesome. The DC guys, some of them are awesome. It's just so many. The New York crew, they're awesome. I love this. I missed you guys here.
Well, congratulations, Jakob. I don't know if we'll be getting the deck list or if you're holding on to it until after Stalic. I know you weren't necessarily planning on playing it, but maybe some of your meta mates are.
Yeah, it's a promise to the meta not to release it until after Stalic, because it was mainly basically a deck for Stalic builds that I wasn't planning to play for Worlds, but ended up doing. So you will get the deck list and from the right person, and it will be out after Stalic.
Splendid. That's all we can ask for. Thank you very much for joining us. We're glad to have you joining us from a hotel room once again, second time in a month. It's beginning to be a habit. Fantastic.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you so much, guys.
All right. So we're going to start off. So we have had the exceptional privilege of having Ryan Jones on to talk about his draft championship. We've had the exceptional privilege of having Jakob to talk about his Joust championship. We know that we cannot get Corey on to talk about his Melee championship, but we would like to talk to the runner-up. Andreas Aldrin, also known as Buzz, was an amazing run up to the final. I will say I was definitely cheering for you in that final. So maybe tell us a little bit about the deck that you decided to take to this tournament. How did it come to be, and why this deck?
So I built on a Greyjoy Aloof deck with Vince. I thought it was so powerful when I faced his first version. And so we decided to keep building on it. And I tried it at Varberg. And it wasn't my type of deck. I played really bad with it. So I told Vince, dude, I need a deck. This sucks. And it's like, oh, well, I have this one list. It's pretty fun. And so he gave me one of the French guys, Martel Bombs. It's so great. It looks so fun, so I took it.
So do you know who took it for that deck, or mm-hmm. who is the author?
I think his name is Marto. I met him in Paris 2 weeks ago. He's a super great guy, and he builds so amazing decks. They are very crisp, very innovative.
So tell us a little bit about your Melee and getting up to that final table. We'll talk about the final table in a bit, but, you know, there was a bunch of rounds before that. Were there any exceptionally interesting decks you ran into, games, plays you did?
So not many super amazing stuff, I think. I played Simone. He wasn't very happy.
Yeah, he didn't have a great tournament.
No. The deck just performed very well for me. I didn't have to do all that much table talk. It just crushed face all day. But, you know, taking captive, going table talking myself into going last. They all marshal. I marshal my Wiper and bomb him. Marshal more stuff. Flip Ariane in the challenges. Flip into manning the city walls. Out with Southern Mercs on a clear board. Nothing they can do.
It's strong, yes, and the Hermitage to give him power icons and things like that. Lots of little synergies in that deck that are quite impressive.
Yeah, jump your Dark Star is fun.
Yes, that too. Yeah. Going into that final, you knew there were two DC players at that table.
That was going to be some trouble.
And not only DC players, it was Seth and Corey.
Yes. So you had to know this was going to be an uphill battle, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah, for sure.
So tell us a little bit about that game, about the earlier rounds and about the ending. I know you're not particularly happy with the ending. No surprise at all there. But
so yeah, I think it was a pretty great game until the end. There wasn't much going on. People made good decisions. I don't remember all too much. It was a 3-hour game, and I so tired.
Yeah, and an hour and a half of that was Ryan Jones's last challenge phase.
Yeah. I'm not sure what to say actually about.
Well, I think there's one big question that a lot of the people following the stream were wondering, which is that you chose to pull out Ariane to get an extra body without triggering her, without using the Kings of Mountain and Vale, taken captive during that challenges phase. What was the reasoning? It would still have triggered.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Forgotten Plans only blanks plots, revealed plots.
Oh, yeah, it's in use by that, so sure.
So that's the explanation. Okay, we were all wondering. We were all okay.
I had no idea. Then I should probably flip it because there were some useless plots for me in there. Like, I didn't need my Fear of the Sun. Then I should have flipped, of course.
Well, now I feel bad saying bring this up. It's just going to be another.
Thank you a lot.
Should I also tell you about the he calls it thinking potential play on a self cancel? No.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing it on make an example, just to put up Darkstar strength, but I didn't feel the need to. No, self canceling was something I was looking into, but no. I didn't like it.
You were in a fairly commanding presence on that last turn. You were sitting at 12 power. You made the decision to go into Summoned by the Conclave. Tell us about the thought process behind that. I know that in the stream a lot of people were talking, he should try and win initiative at this point. He's got the mercenaries. He can make that swing. I don't know whether you had a plot that could do that. You were hoping to drop it into an orphaned recruit or a formal petition and just lock down the game in marshalling. What was the thought process?
So there was three other people at the table who also wanted to win initiative, and they all had less power than me. So flipping into my betrayal was not really an option, and one gold wouldn't let me flip out my mercs.
Yep.
And I knew I still had... I think I had all three of my orphan recruits in the deck. So I was going for Quentin and hoping I'd draw into one of those orphan recruits, which would win me the game in marshalling, but didn't work out. Mm-hmm. So I knew I wouldn't win initiative because I had the most power.
And so that last turn was fairly heated. Seth was playing first. He definitely, at least... My take on it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Seth was definitely playing to win on that turn.
Yeah, it looked like, yeah.
And doing his best. And Ryan then took a very long challenges phase with several questions asked to the judge on multiple occasions, very, very heated in trying to find out what he could do to win the game as well. So I imagine that the controversy comes after that. So tell us about the after that.
Yeah, from your perspective.
Okay, so you're talking about Seth basically deciding?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So Seth asked Nate how the ruling was about that, what happens if I have to choose, or if he feels like he has to choose. This is one of the big questions. And Nate said it was okay, and this is one of the big problems. I didn't like Nate's ruling at all. He told Seth that it was okay, and Seth was happy to give Corey the victory then. There's nothing illegal about it at that point, but, you know, that's not how we play in Europe. It wouldn't have been ruled like that at all, so... Always prolong the game. If you cannot do anything, you should do what makes your position the best, which have made him second or third instead of fourth, I think.
I agree wholeheartedly that you're supposed to play for position, for best possible standing, and that's what's in the tournament rules. I actually thought what was strange was specifically during Ryan Jones's turn, he had asked Nate, and Nate had specifically said that you could not play for anything less than first. In this match, which to me is a very strange call. I think it has to do with the fact that the overall championship no longer exists, and therefore you can't be saying, "Oh, I want to get second because it improves my standing in the overall." And because if that had been the case, for instance, Ryan could have said, "Look, now that after those two power challenges, I can't win. I launched the military challenge against you, and I secure second," right? He could have done that potentially, and it would also have been a legal play under that framework. I think in saying that you had to play for first, the minute that you were no longer in the running for first, you were king-making.
You can do whatever you want, yeah.
And I may not agree with that. I think it's somewhat ironic, perhaps, that by scrapping the overall championship, which has often been accused of warping final tables, I think that in this case it may have done the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. I think having something, yes, symbolic, if it needs to, you know, you could have $16 for the first place and $1 for 16th place. This means that you are forced to play for the best position and best reward all the time at the top.
They could do that so easily, right? They could just say at the top four, each get a different prize based on placement, and then bam, it's done. Right, yeah. Then you have to play for the best prize.
Even simpler. I mean, John has mentioned rankings with point systems for buying prizes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I mean, that would be very easy to implement at that stage as well.
Yeah.
So I think I do want to dig into this a little bit, because I know that it's something that a lot of the community has talked about. Some of it have made it into – I mean, some have gone so far as to say that, you know, Nate was – ruling in favor of USA over Europe. I think this is completely absurd.
I don't think
anybody really believes that. Others, you know, that this is just DC and it's what we should expect, which doesn't mean that we, you know, can't try and improve the rules and the framework to make bitter situations like this not happen. So do you think anything illegal was done?
There was some pretty obvious soft playing going on during the game, I think, but I would have been naive not to expect it, I think. And it was not big enough to warrant any action, you know.
So you're talking about things like Seth and Corey flipping forgotten plans on two different turns and counting coppers to each other, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. You know, flipping forgotten plans was very good for them. And if they would have talked about it and, you know, first I do it and then you do it openly.
But there was no need.
There was no need for that. They knew what to do. But the issue comes when they both also flip counting coppers and trade, not giving it. I understand them not giving it to me because I had a big hand.
You were ahead from turn one, yeah.
But Ryan, he was on the ropes. He needed some cards to be in the game. It creates a bad board position if I can just hit into him all the time. So he needed some cards. Yeah, it was a bad play not to give him cards, which is weird to me. You know.
Yeah, there was also a general, you know, lack of challenges that were meaningful against one another. But as you say, those are the impossible for the judge to act on those.
I was in a table where I sat down. They told me I was never going to get a traded card with anyone the whole game, and they proceeded to trade amongst three for three plots. Mm-hmm. So I feel the pain.
The first turn. It was obvious they didn't want to trade to me, and it was obvious that Ryan didn't want to have the building season, but he felt forced to trade with me anyway, just to improve the board state, which was good, and he realized he could actually search for a horse gate, which is pretty good.
So you're saying there may have been some soft play, which is illegal. I agree actually there wholeheartedly, but impossible to act upon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so then the next question is, do you think there was anything immoral?
Immoral? Well, of course. So even if the ruling was that Seth could kingmake, it's still immoral. It still puts himself down. I think so, in my view. But
that's the funny thing about morals, right? It depends on what you're trying to say. You know, saying European players and American players, I think, have a different moral gauge when it comes to melee.
I think you're generalizing to an unfair extent. I won't even specifically say DC or anything like that. I think that it becomes very difficult to act completely impartially when there's anyone you know at a table.
Well. Yes.
Regardless of whether you're going against them specifically because you dislike them or the opposite, I think it becomes very hard to divorce that from action.
It is very hard, but there are examples from Stalik where the Polish guys, they're on the same table and they do everything to make sure that their guy, their friend doesn't win. And same with the French guys, Vince and Laponte. When you see them on tables, they're on each other's throats all the time, which makes neither of them win usually.
Yeah, but I could just as easily argue that playing like that against your friend is also incorrect. I mean, you're hurting your own standing. Isn't that just as bad? Well, yeah, okay, but let's reduce it to the simplest possible situation. It was discussed in your game, written into the rules. If you two people arrive at 15 power at the same time, the first player chooses a winner.
Oh yeah, that's so stupid. Yeah.
So there is absolutely, given that completely impartial situation in which it can happen between players you don't know or players you do, there's obviously, you can't necessarily call it immoral for the person given that choice to give the win to their friend. Or at least I don't think you can.
No, of course not.
In that completely neutral situation.
But I don't think that rule should exist to begin with. If it's that close, it should either be a regame or a coin flip, I think. But both are not very good either.
Mm-hmm. I know some cases... just like actually in the UK tournament recently, did come down to first player choosing, and he refused to choose and did a coin flip.
Yeah.
And that made a difference. So it certainly can be handled in that impartial way. But I think the way the rules are structured, it certainly tells us that when it doesn't affect your game at all, you have the choice, and that choice is neutral. So I guess the question is, you know, was Seth in sacrificing power, which if he was playing for standing would have been illegal, mm-hmm. but since he was told that he couldn't play for standing, the outcome was neutral to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
of course.
So he got to choose according to those rules and chose his friend.
Yeah, there's no one is surprised by that. I think I would have, if Nate ruled the same, I would have done the same for Jacob or something, but I would still be angry at Nate for ruling that way.
I see, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, you finished that table at 14th. You at 14. I think I would like to touch on one other thing, is that people making this argument that you always have to prolong the game. I definitely see that argument. I want to ask the person himself, can you think of any combination of cards that could have stopped you from, say, winning dominance?
No.
Okay,
not off the bat. I don't think so.
Yeah, but that's sort of what I'm wondering. The people who say, "Well, he should have stopped Corey because then we can do everything we can to try and stop Andres." And doing everything we can and knowing that we can stop him are two different things. I understand that.
And if you know you can't, what you're saying, Alex, is that it's a harder decision.
It brings it closer to that sort of first player decides kind of thing. If you know that Andres does win if you don't let these through.
So there's a lot of examples where in Stalik, I did this stupidly. So it was 100% sure assured win for me, but they didn't talk about it openly on the table, and I didn't notice it. Now, this would have been a more obvious thing, just stand for dominance or make a military somewhere with my mercs. But you know, there's always someone who makes a challenge, and oops, someone who's supporting him, guess I don't win. There's always people making mistakes or hitting cards or something that enables this philosophy that we Europeans have about prolonging the game as long as possible.
Yeah, I see that. So let's, in order to end it on a slightly happier note, let's assume that the reason that Seth was forced into that choice is that he thinks you're such an amazing player that there is no way
imaginable
impossible that you could screw him. And it was a compliment to you. He said, look, Andres is just that good. He's got it locked.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand that this scenario, it's I don't. There was impossible for me not to win if it came to me.
All right. Well, so I know that Melee experience, you know, you weren't particularly happy with how the Melee final played out. I hope you had a good tournament. I hope you had a good Worlds and had fun. Maybe tell us a little bit about your experiences just very briefly in the other tournaments.
Yeah, it was great. I had lots of fun, met lots of good people, including the DC crew. Corey, I talked to him a lot yesterday. He's such a great guy. Even Seth, when he's not on the internet, he's very nice. yeah, there was a lot of really great people, and, you know, meeting all these old champions whose champ cards I've been playing with, great fun. Going out drinking all night, which I shouldn't have done before the Melee. It was so fun to do well in the Melee after. I didn't play really that well in Joust, and the deck crapped at me. And then doing pretty well in second edition as well, after having played one game before.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
also nice.
You got to feature on the stream, and it was great to see you with that Targros. Also, any thoughts of – are you – what did you think of the 2.0 tournament? Were you, you know – that many rounds after that many days of playing with a core environment could potentially be quite dull. I haven't heard any first-hand accounts. What did you feel?
So looking at the core environment, I think it really looks dull. But this deck that OK Targ built with Jacob, it was really fun. Seal of the Hand Margaery and Handmaidens Margaery or Danny, it was so fun. People were annoyed or they just pull their hair, like, what can I do about this? Well, nothing. But also, I don't like second ed yet. So many of my games I won just because I blew them out of the water first turn, and I didn't see Varys. I should have had them in my plot deck, I guess.
So you're holding out for a Valor in second edition.
Yeah.
is how I translate that.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, well, thank you so much again for joining us, especially, you know, short notice from cramming all this into your trip to the States.
Yeah, see you.
We're joined by Little C, the love child of Corey Faraday and Eric Butzloff.
Doesn't both he eventually of get to pick his year? Own nickname?
No.
He performed so well this weekend.
Yeah, but you know why he performed so well? Because he has this genetic makeup that makes him a winner.
Congratulations.
For not winning any events.
I was just saying to Alex how that's a dirty taste, but you deserve a card designed for the consistent showing this year kind of everywhere.
And in fact, I think we have you quoted as saying that you measure someone's skill in a card game by consistent performance and average performance across events.
I actually do think that, and I think it was as good a week as I've seen someone have a stretch of big tournaments. I'm proud.
I'm glad you deserve to be proud. You performed exceptionally well in three very different formats. So for those of you who don't know, Seth was at every final table in the 1.0 game. So he was at the final table in Draft, in Joust, and Melee. Maybe we'll start with him in a little bit of chronological order and just tell us a little bit about the prep that you did for Draft. We heard that DC came in with a little bit of a strategy and analyzing the card pool. What came out of that?
We actually prepared a lot, and our preparation did not pay off. We ordered a bunch of draft packs for the second draft pool. We found them on sale. So I think Chad Jamnick ordered about 20 of them, 12 of them, some large amount. And we found pretty quickly just how it's broken down, the commons, the rares. We started looking at the commons for every house to see, okay, who has the most easily constructible deck. And what we found with the second pool, we found that Lannister and Targaryen just had the best spread of common cards that you knew if you started drafting those houses, you weren't going to end up without a very good deck or with no intrigue icons or something like that.
Well, I think to some extent that must have worked for you guys, because there were quite a few DC in that cut, including yourself and Eric Butzlaff. And
you played draft too, right? You didn't just look at the card pool. You actually played the game.
We played some, but we also did a lot of practice drafts where we would just everybody flip up 10. We talk about what you would pick and you keep one. And then we would actually move around the table, keeping things face up. So everybody were talking about all of our picks and the logic. And we kind of got into a system where we understood everybody was kind of on the same page about our evaluations. And one of the things we found with the second pool that was interesting is that the plot cards, other than a few plot cards, you really don't want to draft plots very high in the second pool. In the first pool, the two claim plots are so key. But in the second pool, the plots in the starter are much better. So the difference between the one you pick and the one you cut from your deck is a lot smaller.
Any quick stories about the final match, or
draft in general?
The final match, I got lucky. I got pretty lucky earlier. Like I said, I think Ryan had a better deck. But in my opening, when I drew back up, I had two Milk of the Poppy and a fishing net, and that let me slow him down a lot, because he dropped Rob, immediate Milk of the Poppy. He dropped a Blackfish, immediate Milk of the Poppy. And then he had a Frozen Solid, but I was able to fishing net someone else, so he had to freeze fishing net, and I kept those two bomb characters with the Milk on them, so he couldn't accelerate. And all I was trying to do is get to that first wildfire. I wanted to stretch it out, make him overplay, and then wildfire and come back. But by the time I got there, I was drawing locations, and he had a couple more characters. He got the big guy, and that was it. But he deserved it.
And comments about the draft format in general, then? Because you said you're not a drafter, and you did very well. Is it
three
a format
pods,
you enjoy? Is it a different format you're not sure about?
I think going in, I had a perception that maybe draft was the most skill-based format, and coming out, I think it's probably the least skill-based format. And I think that because there's a second level of luck beyond the normal luck that's in playing the game, just what do you see and what do you get past? I mean, you play around it as best you can. You have a good plan of what houses and what to evaluate cards, but the extra element of what you see informing how well you can do, I think it's probably the most luck-based.
I'm not entirely sure I agree, but I can certainly see where you're coming from.
I can understand the perception. I'm with Alex. I don't know if there's as much luck, because everyone in your pod is suffering from that. So it's really about picking the right cards and the right decks and sending the right signals.
Yeah, the other reason I say is you get a situation like another one of the Southern California guys. I want to say James Speck, I think. I played against him in the cut. His first draft, he opened the first 10 cards, and he got on Raven's Wings, the 1-3-1 where you go and search your deck.
And then
his
Danny.
Second 10 was Danny. So, like, if you see that,
you win.
It's not skill, you just win.
That may just be a problem with the draft construction, and that you can't allow a card like Danny to stick around.
Yeah, I agree. And I think blind draft is more skilled than the set draft. So if you were to play in a major draft event at Lake Worlds and they had a new draft pack that very time, I think that takes so much more skill than a pre-constructed draft where everyone knows the cards in the draft ahead of time.
I actually disagree.
I agree with you.
You disagree, Alex?
Yeah.
Why?
I think that the more information you can use to formulate a strategy, the more skill-driven it is.
No, it's more practice-driven, right? It's the more practice-driven. What you're saying is that people have time to memorize all the cards, their rarity in a draft pack are more skilled. I don't think it's more skilled. It's more definitely more dedication and more work put into it, but it's not the same as skill.
I think that what you're talking about is an intuitive thing, which is certainly very important, but you can also be tricked. I mean, you can build along certain assumptions in a card pool that you're going into completely blind and not realize that Valor exists or doesn't exist and
right.
have completely
– It's all surprise. You have to play with your skill in mind. You have to be able to break down the
drafting
barriers of assumptions. Your assumptions are wrong. You can't assume, right? It makes you an ass.
I think at that point it's closer to guesswork. I don't think that's
skill. Oh, I think that's skill. I think that it's – it's skill to really assess each card in and of its own merit. But anyways, that's a different topic.
It is.
Another
it is
day.
A different topic. So,
we're
so
talking about Seth right now.
Day two was Joust. So having made the cut, you'd played late into the draft. And so you were running the DC-approved solution?
Yeah, something like that. We had a couple decks we thought were up there. And
well, what were they?
Stark Harrenhal, Stark House of Dreams Harrenhal. I really liked that running that deck, we could run 14 resources because you're searching the top three. So if you get too many resources early, you can find more characters and vice versa. So being able to run the extra resources made a very balanced deck. I really like the cities because they give you a great late game. You know, if someone doesn't have cities, if you can just get to that fourth plot where you're kneeling and then double kneeling or whatever, it's just very powerful. And we thought that Stark in general will be strong because of the Direwolf sort of combination. So putting the card advantage, the resource base, that means your deck rarely craps out on you, and the Direwolves together. That's why I love that deck.
What were the other DC approved solutions?
We really liked Targ Summer with Rainey's Hill because
John liked that one.
yeah, we just love that late in the game, if it's a close game, you can drop two Rainies, if not three Rainies in a row, and if they don't have an immediate answer, it's going to be hard for someone to beat you.
Right. Was there any others, or those were the two decks that you liked the most?
Those are the ones. We really liked Stark Conquest Lannister. And
Paw
I know,
Patrol.
Yep. There was a version that Dave played in Boston.
Yep.
But that deck was more fragile than the other two. It could go more boom, but it could also bust.
Yeah, for sure. With a badly timed City Besieged, blows up your cash and your location, it can be pretty sad.
Yeah, the cash is too risky, I thought.
Yeah.
So, interesting fact. Do you know that you and I won the same number of games at our Worlds, me last year and you this year? And we lost the same number of games?
I didn't know. That's funny.
There you go. So you performed admirably. I mean, you were top of the Swiss. You suffered the single elimination. You were playing a single elimination tournament. Your opponent was playing a triple elimination tournament in the final. So that's always a little tough to take.
I feel obviously. For you, Seth. One loss all day, and it happened to be then the top two.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's okay. I think Jakob, he beat me, and he earned it, and it was his day. But I also feel like, you know, I still had the best record of the whole tournament at the end of the day. Nobody else had played all the games and only had one loss. So I feel like it was my day, too. But he definitely got me.
He definitely did in that final. This is completely tangential, but actually when people got to see you play Dave Bamford, but there was this huge reaction when you – basically double Harrenhal, you Harrenhal in one turn and then you Harrenhal into the next, and you basically manage to pick out the narrow escape that saves you, well, that eases the game against.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about this.
But the thing is, people saying that was luck is it's incorrect. I mean, you get to search top six cards of your deck in that case for the answer to what's happening on that next turn.
And you have a little trigger, to know
so
it.
You actually got a chance to search the top 11. So that's just...
But I think the key to it is I overplayed on purpose because I would love if I got a narrow escape. I know I can lock the game down, but even if I don't, I'm looking across the board. He's got a bunch of cards in hand, but he only had, I think, one or two resources. And I'm looking at my hand, and I have a lot of cheap characters. I have Kyle, I have a Carrion Bird, I have, I think, a Refugee. So I know that if he Velars, he's going to have a turn with no resources and cards in his hand he can't play, and I'm coming out equally hard right on that turn. And I can play Time for Wolves. If he doesn't have it, he calls it. I'll have a big guy on the table as well. So even without the narrow, it would have been a much more difficult game, but I had a plan, and that's why I pushed him to do it. Mm-hmm. Getting the narrow just kind of locked it down.
Yeah, I agree. I did have a deck question. Now I remember what it was. We, John and I, had tested a similar version of that deck, actually extremely similar version of that deck, going into Gen Con, and I think you guys probably refined it quite a bit. But there's a card I was very surprised not to see in your deck, and that card is Northern Patriarch.
We were big on the Patriarch. We started out with two in the deck, and we ended up with zero.
So what went into that process? I mean, it could have made a big difference against Yakko.
Dark Wings, Dark Words, yeah.
It could have made a big difference, but probably wouldn't have. We found with Patriarch just overall, he's only good in a too narrow set of circumstances. We played tons of games with him. Zero times did he survive your opponent's Velar. And them having to play around and just waiting to play an event and then Velaring later and then saving the event so that he will be killed, that wasn't good enough of a reason to keep him in there. You know, he just wasn't pulling his weight. He would be great early against like Martell, where you could pull him down turn one, keep mm-hmm. them from getting power. They can't Sivas you, and you're on your way. But mostly we were drawing him, and he wasn't doing a lot.
Interesting. I also found him rather useful against Targ to ensure that I could get the challenges through on that first turn that I needed to for things like burn, reporters yeah. and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
No one's we just found him to be way too low impact later in games, too big of a liability. So we went down to one, and then eventually, as we were finding more cards, we wanted to get in there. Lots of stealth. We really wanted a lot of stealth. We wanted a lot of three strength intrigue so that we could survive Sivas. We ended up cutting him.
Well, I'm glad to hear your reasoning behind that. That's an interesting choice. Which brings me on to my next question. So we've had a couple of champions on this cast, and because of the timing, many of them are holding their decks for Stalic. Will DC be posting their deck list?
Yeah, we definitely are. We're going to post the Harrenhal deck, and if people are interested in our other decks, we'd probably post those as well. Yeah, I think the Harrenhal deck...
Let's see your Shared Conquest. Let's see your Summer.
Yeah, sure. If people want them, I'd be happy to post them.
I think people do, and I think people would be interested in seeing if you guys can back a few horses in Stalic, too. Agreed. All right, well, let's move on to the subject of this time of year, every year. Day 3, the Melee, top 4, 2 of them are from the illustrious District of Columbia meta, yourself and Corey Faraday. So I think there's
been some drama, Seth.
Yeah, there has.
They all agree that within the letter of the rules, what you did was correct, just as a line. However, there are some hard feelings, we'll say, Alex. Is it hard feelings?
I think that there's a perception that it would have gone differently with the way that Europe is supposedly handles melees.
Yeah, it's kind of like a moral difference or a philosophy difference, actually, better.
I think there's a perceived unwritten rule, Europe.
Where you screw your metamates.
No, I don't necessarily think that's the case.
I don't know. They always tell me, like, the French guys kill each other, the Polish guys kill each other. It kind of sounds like you kill your metamates.
But I think that real point that a lot of people are making is that you should always attempt to prolong a game.
Yeah. No matter what.
Right.
Well, I was going to write a big post, you know, about it. Or not a big post, but just trying to explain the situation. It's really bothersome to see on AGOT cards people calling me a cheater, people calling Corey a cheater. I think it's really pretty much baseless. There is a misunderstanding where some European players feel like there is an unwritten rule that every action you make as a player, if you can't win, you're extending the game. And
yeah, that's my understanding as well.
That's exactly it.
But it is an unwritten rule.
I don't know if it's written or not. I mean, I don't criticize that philosophy, but we don't really have – I feel like as a Melee player, I've played in 4 Melee tournaments. I don't think there is a Melee culture in the United States. Like, I don't think there is – a culture of a certain way things are done. It's almost like every table, people have a little bit different expectations. There's sometimes there's a lot more deal making and someone will let someone else win because they made a deal earlier. Sometimes there's more teamwork. People have different expectations at each table and you have your own space of what you feel like is what right and wrong, where to operate. And I felt like at our final table, I got to a point based on that whole round of table talk with Ryan talking and Nate being there and explaining things. I felt like I had a decision point, not a player action, but a decision point between the two players, and that Nate was on board with the notion that you're at a decision point. This is where you are making a choice who will win. And if that runs counter to the European style of the game, it's only because we don't have that style here, not because I was trying to cheat Andreas out of a card design.
I will say we had Andreas on, and it was basically a very tame set of comments. I mean,
Ryan, too, very tame.
I will also – I mean, obviously, at first blood, nobody likes feeling like they got shafted, and you're going to feel like you got shafted, you know, even if it came down to the – incinerate Daenerys coin toss and you give it to Corey. I'm happy to jump on the DC villain train. This just isn't one of those times.
And you're getting a lot mellower, Alex, this year, because in previous years, he just lost his mind about Bruno doing basically the same thing.
But yeah, and so that's why I can't criticize the community at all in their reaction, because I understand it. I did the same thing in jumping on Bruno, who I felt had soft played and handed a win in 2013 in Melee. But now,
well, I think if there are two differences, one with the community's reaction, some people just don't have the facts right. Like Lord Hakera online is saying that I was in second place and allowed Corey to knock me down. I was in fourth place, and there, so I was at a point where my standing, I couldn't play that one way to support my standing. It's not like I could make something else,
I'll even go further than that and say that you were actually explicitly forbidden for playing for standing.
Yes, that is correct.
Nate specifically stated that people could not play for standing, which is different from every other year. Because of the overall, because you were competing for overall, and so you were under no obligation to protect your power once you believed you couldn't win. You and the DC. I mean, I think I might be able to level some accusations of soft play in the coordination of plots between you and Corey, and some of the challenge decisions that did not negatively affect each other in any significant way. But let's be fair. I could probably level those same allegations against maybe Ryan's decision to incinerate your Euron that early on.
Yep, and that's why I haven't brought that up, because I'm sure there was some of that going around on all sides. But that's, and that is Melee. I'm not going to worry about that. But the idea that I broke a very specific rule is frustrating.
Anyone who's arguing that you broke an actual rule is wrong. Nate was there. The people who are arguing that what you did was immoral, if you reduce the problem to the Daenerys problem, they think it's fine, right? To the prize problem. They say, fine, yes, if you simultaneously thing, and the first player has to make a decision. It's a stupid rule, and we hate it, but it wouldn't have been a problem. And they don't understand that this is the same thing.
It's an extension of it, but they have a mechanical definition of when you are choosing, when you're at the decision point. Their mechanical definition is just different from what existed at our final table, and yeah. Nate was there to set that definition.
Yeah, so I think in that respect, you're blameless. I mean, honestly, I think that had there been an overall this year, you would have taken second, and you would have had to hand it to Andreas.
Oh yeah, I mean,
had there been an overall, but I don't think it would have been illegal too. It's what I did last year, right?
Getting an attack from a warrior of note or something, yeah.
Yeah, after you take some power with a massive challenge against doesn't matter who, and then you do a little military against him and give him the 15th, and you secure second because you weren't going to get first. And that would have not been a controversial play at all. And it wasn't, at least as far as I know, in 2014, there was no controversy about me being out of the running and then launching a challenge against Kid to give him 15 power so that I could take second and eventually win overall.
Yeah, and that was the play that gave you the overall as well. It is funny. I think part of it is just me and Corey, same meta, DC. Yeah. That was all part of it.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think this is a case where you guys are being hard done by, I think. And,
did you hear briefly about the top 16 table I was at?
I did not.
So that was interesting as well, and had the potential probably to be more controversial, because it was me, Eric Butzloff, and Aaron Broderick, and Jakob.
Yeah, so Jakob hasn't mentioned anything about it, so I don't know. I mean, to be fair, I know that at Gen Con, John was locked out of the final table by DC collusion, two DCs and Peter ensuring that they would never trade with John and never support John. These things happen, but I didn't hear anything about Jakob's table. So what happened?
Well, that's the funny thing is we made a point. We knew there would be scrutiny, so we were like, we're not going to talk beforehand. Obviously, outside of the game, we would prefer for one of us to win, but we're not going to do that. We'll play it. So the first thing that happens is we flip trade plots, and Jakob flips Condemned, because he's playing Tarik Hollow Hill, Condemned by the Realm. So his goal is to trade with someone playing Summoning Season, offer them the Condemned choice, and he will go and get Rhaegar Targaryen from his deck. But I had the fastest start, and I knew if he got Rhaegar Targaryen, it would be a free reset on the board. So I'm arguing with Eric and Aaron to say we should lock him out of this trade. There's no reason for us to empower this great deck. This is the one play he needs to stay in this game. If we just don't trade with him, then we cannot worry about him. Plus, on top of that, he has to give one of us the Condemned by the Realm anyway. We're not getting anything in return by doing this. So Jakob is upset by this, obviously, and we had an 18-minute plot phase talking it over, and eventually I told Eric, I was the only one who flipped Counting Favors, and I said, Eric, I will not give you the cards unless you don't give your Summoning Season to Jakob. And Eric really wanted to get Incinerates. So we ended up locking Jakob out of that trade, but not because of collusion and not because we were in the meta, but because of just the game state and the arguments that we were making back and forth. And after the game, I told Jakob I wanted to talk to him. I took him aside and I tried to explain to him, and he understood completely. He said, no, you know, as the game was going on, I understood this was not a collusion thing. This was your playing strategy because you're ahead thing. I should actually run, but thank you so much for having me on.
Today's tip of the week is going to be worlds themed, and surprisingly, it's not about Sam Bratz's deck. But Kid Seafelt, who's an excellent 1.0 player, also from Wisconsin, from that same meta, we got to see his top four game. He lost to Patrick Haynes, but it was a really interesting match, and I strongly recommend it to anyone who has a tendency to scoop when things have really hit the fan. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, the vast majority of us watching were convinced that he was going to lose this when we saw Die by the Sword hit Danny on a turn where he just couldn't maintain the number of characters he needed on the board. And he ground that out to within one play of the win. And unfortunately, he gambled on a slightly different outcome. He didn't think there would be a third put to the sword, and it cost him the game. But he was within striking distance of the win, and that was, what, three plots after Danny had been put to the sword and we had written him off? So, yeah, this is an exercise in playing out the games, in the value of intrigue and power challenges. I strongly recommend that. If you're skeptical, as an educational tool, check out that Twitch video. Excellent game there by Kid Seafelt.
Yeah, it's not like Kid's a new player either. Kid's been doing this for a while, and he's pretty friggin' solid.
Closing comments, John. It's been a long one. I actually have a couple of things, though.
It has been a crazy one. A lot of last-minute recording.
A lot of last-minute editing. In fact, we're recording this at a time where our podcast would normally already be posted, and I still have 2 hours of assembly ahead of me. So this will be lots of fun.
Yeah. So all of our listeners, help, you know, thank Alex for his dedication to this podcast. It's kind of crazy.
Right. Where was I? Tournaments. I actually decided today, I was invited by Dan Struhall from New York to come down. He was going to help a little bit with some travel arrangements. I managed to squeak around my schedule. So I will actually be going to Red Saturday on November 28th in New York. I'm very much looking forward to that. It's a 2.0 tournament, and it's going to be a blast. I mean, time in New York always is. That crew is a phenomenal bunch of players. But also, absolutely, thank you to Dan Struhall for reaching.
Yes. I mean, New York is always a great crew to hang out with, let alone play with. You know, they're a strong 2.0 scene. I think it's going to be a great time. I'm going to try to make it out too, but I'll have to ask the wife first.
That sounds dangerous. I also want to mention some of the other tournaments that I'd mentioned before. The Singapore Nationals on November 14th coming up, the Philippine 2.0 Nationals coming up on November 29th. And maybe, John, you could tell us a little bit about what the episode next week is going to look like?
We're going to talk a little bit with the 2.0 champions, so that should be pretty fun.
Yeah, we have a couple of recordings scheduled, and I think you may not know this, but I actually just received some tokens from Dracula's Tokens to review on the cast, so I expect to get to that next week as well.
I have seen nothing of that type, so.
So people have to trust my exquisite taste.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't trust Alex's taste in anything like that.
All right. Yeah, I think we got to be done, though. I think I can't edit anymore.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
Kaylee is doing what?
Spelling.
Kaylee's doing spelling, and you're helping her with spelling?
No.
Oh,
no. My wife told me I'm not allowed, actually.